I'm Jonathan Capehart, in today for Leonard Lopate. Chicken is the world's most popular meat. I can guarantee it because I love it. At this moment, most meat animals across the planet are raised with the assistance of antibiotics, equating to about 126 million pounds yearly. In her new book, Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats, Maren McKenna writes about the rise of chicken from a local delicacy to global commodity and how it paved the way for a stunning transformation of farming worldwide. It is published by National Geographic, and I am pleased it's brought Maren McKenna to the show today. And first off, I must apologize that for the past 90 minutes in every tease and every everything, I've been mispronouncing your name, but it's Maren McKenna. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. How'd you decide to write a book about the history and current industry of chicken?
So I am a science writer. And for the past couple of years, I've been really immersed in the problem of antibiotic resistance, how bacteria are growing to resist antibiotics, what a serious health problem that is worldwide. And so I was listening to a lot of medical people say, we have to be very careful about antibiotics. They are these great miracle drugs. We waste them. We use them inappropriately. And in the midst of that research, I stumbled across this statistic that we give farm animals 4 times as many antibiotics as go into humans just in the United States. And I couldn't figure out how those two things could exist in the same time and space. And I had to find out why.
Four times. But I mean, is it that chickens or animals are battling that many more?
No, like that's sick? The problem. So here's the fundamental disconnect. We are super conservative around antibiotics in humans, and we tell people only take these when you are sick, only take them when you have a bacterial infection. Be sure you have the right drug for the right infection. Almost all of the antibiotics that we use in farm animals in the United States, in Europe, worldwide, go into animals that are not sick. They go to increase their weight in a process that dates back to the 1940s. And they also go to protect them against the diseases that they're vulnerable to in the crowded conditions of modern high-throughput meat production.
So you start off your book by talking about Rick Schiller. Now, talk about Rick Schiller and how he got sick and what kind of symptoms he was exhibiting.
So Rick is an amazing story, and he's amazing for 2 reasons. First, because he was so sick, and also because he's really not that unusual, because it's very common in the United States and around the world now for people to have cases of foodborne illness that are antibiotic resistant. And when we think of foodborne illness, we probably think of feeling a little queasy or spending a little more time in the bathroom. But Rick Schiller wakes up in the middle of the night in his house in Southern California, and he can feel his leg throbbing. And when he looks down, he realizes that his leg is about twice the size that it ought to be. And it's red and purple and frightening looking. And it's stiff as a log. He can't bend it. So understandably, he shrieks. And he and his girlfriend try to get him out of the house and into his tiny little car. I think he had a Miata. And get him to a hospital where they figure he must have some sort of like burgeoning infection inside his leg, some sort of abscess or something that they have to tap. And they can't find anything. They can't find anything that accounts for the fact that his leg has become grossly non-functional and frightening to look at. What they eventually figure out is that he has a foodborne illness that is antibiotic resistant, that has caused this inflammatory reaction throughout his body that is it's just choking off the circulation in his leg. And he almost loses the leg. And fortunately, he does, for the most part, recover.
How long did it take them to discover that it was a foodborne illness and that antibiotics were the culprit, the antibiotics in whatever it was he ate?
So this is complicated. Rick was one of more than 600 victims in an outbreak that originated at a chicken processor in California, but caused cases in 30 states and also Puerto Rico. So putting together an outbreak like that, when it's so so broad in geography, and in some cases also so divorced in time from the product, because you buy chicken and maybe you take it home and eat it, but maybe you put it in your freezer and
right,
it's there
and
for a while.
Right, and don't eat it for months. Yeah.
It took, so this outbreak was investigated by the Centers for Disease Control, which is how I found out about it, and it went on for almost a year before they really put all the pieces together, found the culprit food, tried to take the steps to get it off the market or persuade the processor to take it off the market. And during all that time, more and more people were getting sick.
And so talk about Foster Farms. How is Foster Farms involved?
So Foster Farms was the chicken processor, the producer. And the thing about Foster Farms is they are one of many very large chicken companies across the country that oversee every aspect of chicken raising. They have farmers who work for them. They bring the farmers the chicks. The farmers grow up the chickens. The company takes them back. They slaughter them. They package them. They distribute them. They're not at all unusual. And they also weren't unusual in their processes. It's not like they were extraordinarily bad actors. The entire astonishing thing about this very large outbreak was really how normal it was for food production in America today.
How normal it was for just the
for the size of the outbreak, for the fact that the animals had gotten antibiotics, for the fact that the antibiotic-resistant bacteria that had arisen in the animal systems, in the chicken systems, had ended up on the meat, had been distributed across the country. I mean, we live within a food production system that, because of this little-known use of antibiotics as we're growing up the animals that become meat, makes us all really vulnerable to this and has been really for decades.
So is antibiotic resistance, is it common?
Yeah. So
how does that happen?
Sure. So the things that we call antibiotics, the compounds, the chemical compounds, are in their origin were things that bacteria made to defend themselves against each other really before we came on the scene to compete for living space and for sources of nutrition. And we in the 1940s took those crude compounds into the lab, made copies of them, and called them antibiotics. Well, bacteria had always been defending each other, defending themselves against each other. And when we introduced our synthesized versions of their chemical weapons, they kept on doing right that. So when we deploy an antibiotic, bacteria respond in a way that protects them against the action of that antibiotic. And so if there's a certain number of bacteria in someone's body, in an animal's guts, and we give them an antibiotic, the vulnerable bacteria die, but the bacteria that already have the protection not only survive, they're very happy to expand into that living space that's just been emptied. And so this burgeons and goes on and on.
So now that we know that there are antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which also should remind all of us that bacteria have been, I think you said, been here longer than we have, and so they are used to fighting for their own survival. But the idea that you've got these, what is it, the superbug, I think was the big thing people were talking about. Is there a way to overcome this resistance to antibiotics? Is it possible to outsmart the bacteria?
Well, the way you outsmart bacteria is by having a better antibiotic. And that's one reason why this both misuse of antibiotics in medicine, but certainly misuse of antibiotics in agriculture is such a problem, is because we're getting to the point where there is no new antibiotic, where since the beginning of the antibiotic era, we've been in this sort of leapfrog between bacterial resistance and a new drug and new resistance and a new drug. And just about 10 years ago, pharma manufacturers decided that game of leapfrog was no longer in their economic interest. Huh. So there are almost no new super strong antibiotics on the market. I mean, if you were a pharma company and somebody said to your shareholders, we are going to make a drug that will cost 10 years and $1 billion to make, and when we put it out in the market, within about 4 years, maybe 20% of the things we use it for might not work anymore, and we might not make our money back, your shareholders are probably going to say, maybe you should make Viagra instead.
do something else completely.
Insulin, something, yeah.
So instead of it being a decision that's driven by the fact that this is having adverse impact on consumers and the health of people, it was, as all things, driven by the bottom line.
Yeah. Unfortunately, our antibiotic manufacturers in America, they're not nationalized. They respond to the market.
Right.
And the market has been telling them that these drugs that they've been making for 70 years now are really not a good investment. And so when we encounter, as people, antibiotic-resistant infections, we don't have the defenses against them that we could have relied on before.
What's colistin? Colistin?
You can say it either way. It sort of depends which country you're in.
Colistin. What is it?
So colistin is a drug that I think a lot of people are going to hear about soon. It actually dates back to the beginning of the antibiotic era. It's a really old, crude antibiotic from the 1950s. It's still around because since it was so crude and had a lot of side effects, it kind of hung out in the back of the medicine cabinet. No one really wanted to use it until this game of leapfrog that I was just talking about got us to the point where we were running out of other antibiotics. And suddenly, medicine, just in the past couple of years, turned to this old drug and said, wow, for the most serious and multi-drug-resistant infections, the kind that occur to people who are in hospital ICUs or who have cancer chemotherapy and are vulnerable to infection, we're going to need to use that drug. What medicine didn't realize is that in all the decades that it had been neglecting this drug and not using it, agriculture had embraced it with great enthusiasm and was using it by the ton in animals to prevent mostly respiratory infections in very crowded barns. And so just a couple of years ago, in the fall of 2015, researchers in China announced that they had found bacteria resistant to colistin, this very last resort drugs, at the same time in patients, in pigs, and in retail pork in China. And by the time they announced that, the superbug that they dubbed MCR for mobile colistin resistance had been found in about, that had spread to about 30 countries. And it's here in the United States as well.
So what you're saying is there is an antibiotic resistant thing that there's nothing that can blow it out, that can kill it, because this is the last of the leapfrog.
That's
Am
true.
I following?
No, you're right. And this is not the only bacterium for which that's the case. I mean, as I've been writing about antibiotic resistance over the past couple of years, I have met so many physicians who have said to me, I have had patients for whom nothing worked because that game of leapfrog had gotten to its last leap.
Could this lead to a post-antibiotics era?
It could, in fact, yeah. This is a real concern. And that's why I wrote this book. And that's why people say in hospitals and in doctors' offices, you must use antibiotics conservatively. Because the more we encourage bacteria toward resistance beyond the reach of the antibiotics that we have, the more we invite that post-antibiotic era to come closer and closer. And what that means when I say a post-antibiotic era.
Yeah, because how does that work?
It's the pre-antibiotic era. Come back again. It's really simple things. Breaking your leg, scratching your face, giving birth to a baby, cutting yourself shaving are things that could cause an infection that could kill you. My own great uncle, actually, who was a fireman here in Manhattan, he had a nozzle of a fire hose fall on him in the firehouse in 1938. And he just got kind of bumped and bruised and scratched. And a month later, he died of septic shock. It was 3 years before the first test of penicillin. I mean, just a simple little injury like that caused his death.
I'm still trying to understand if we are we're at that point where, like, there's nothing to stop the killer bacteria. How we then are able to, in a sense, go back in time to the pre-antibiotics era. Mm-hmm. Is it that we become super careful? Is it that manufacturers, the food processors, whether it's chicken or beef or whatever, that they wean their livestock off of antibiotics, and that's how we get back to the pre-era?
So we'd be in a post-antibiotic era when most of the infections that we worry about no longer respond to antibiotics. In effect, it would be as though we never had antibiotics at all.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we keep that from happening is the question. How do we keep from getting there? And the answer for agriculture certainly is that we just stop misusing these drugs. Now here in the United States, we took a step toward that. As of January of this year, the kind of antibiotics that they give to animals to make them grow faster, with this usage that dates back to the 1940s, that's supposed to not happen in the U.S. anymore. But there's still the kind of antibiotic use in animals that protects them against infections in crowded barns and feedlots. We're still allowing that. Europe still allows that. China and India do that. So there's a really significant amount of antibiotic use around the world still that is going to make us vulnerable to resistance because it's causing bacteria to evolve in a way that we're not keeping track of.
I'm Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate, and my guest is Maren McKenna. We are discussing her book, Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We'll be right back after a break. And I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. This is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. And Maren McKenna and I are talking about chickens and antibiotics. And Maren McKenna, and we're talking about this because Maren McKenna is the author of Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. Okay, who is Jesse Dixon Jewell? And how does this person fit in?
So Jesse Dixon Jewell is a hero where I live in Georgia. I live in Atlanta because he essentially created the modern chicken industry. And he created it in the hills of northeast Georgia, which was otherwise a place that was extremely economically disadvantaged. So chickens used to be a thing that everybody's grandmother had sort of out the back door, mm-hmm. you know, a few running around. They were probably there for eggs. And after they lived out their useful life laying eggs, then you killed them. And they weren't very tasty. So that was a pretty, there just weren't very many chickens coming out of a system like that. So Jewell, coming out of the very poor hills of northeast Georgia, wondering how to improve his family's finances in this very disadvantaged area, has the idea to start treating chickens not as individual things in your backyard, but as things kind of on an assembly line, sort of like Model A cars. So he imagines an industry in which the chickens belong not to individual farmers or farmers' wives, but to a company. And that company is going to control the production by buying the feed, hatching the chicks, taking the chicks to farmers to raise, taking the chickens back when they're grown, slaughtering them, processing them, packaging them, and distributing them, a vertically organized corporation. He's the first one to think of this and the first one to think, all of the profit from all of that is going to flow in one direction, which is up to the corporation
right.
that's holding all of those assets. So chicken farmers really become kind of chicken renters. They're only holding the birds and for, you know, 6 to 8 weeks of their lives and then tendering them back again.
What's the incentive for a farmer to do that? I mean, is it extremely profitable even for that farmer who just holds these chicks to chickens for 8 weeks?
Well, most of the farmers will tell you no. So farmers grow chickens and increasingly other kinds of meat as well on this contract system in which they're really just kind of borrowing the birds. And they get paid at the end of the birds' lives for the weight that the birds gained minus the cost of the feed and some other inputs into them like power and water and so forth. Usually, there are multiple farmers in an area and they get judged against each other. So whoever comes out on top in that round of growing chickens is usually doing very well, is usually pretty happy with this industry. But for as much as there's someone on top, there's always someone on the bottom. Mm-hmm. So this whole organization of benefiting the corporation but pitting farmers against each other is something that's been controversial for a couple of years now. The Obama administration thought they were going to do something about it, and then they backed off.
Okay, so now the chicken industry is growing.
Yes.
But a lot of people weren't eating chicken. Why was that?
So If you think back to what chickens used to look like, which is not really like what the chickens we eat today
are. Right, they're
yard birds. They were like, yard birds, yeah, right. They were kind of upright and skinny, and they ran around a lot, and they were kind of stringy. So there's this interesting sort of cycle in the story of chicken where supply keeps getting out in front of demand. So the Jesse Dixon Jewell and his ilk have this idea to create these corporations that produce a lot of chicken. But then they have to convince people to eat a lot of chicken. Mm-hmm. And if you go back 50 years, 60 years, we didn't actually eat that much chicken, first because they were still kind of stringy birds. And second, because if you think of a chicken on a platter, a chicken has kind of a size problem. I mean, it's a little too big for, especially a few years ago, for two people to eat, but it's probably not enough for a family to eat. And we don't have any history, the way we do with cattle and with pigs, of taking chickens and making them into other things like, you know, chicken sausage or chicken salami or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was always just there was a chicken, you ate it, and then you were done
that day, right?
Exactly. So the chicken industry has to figure out a way to get people to eat more chicken. And that evolution results in the thing that most people eat most days in this country, which is the chicken nuggets. Because what the chicken nugget really represents, it's the chicken nugget. Everyone thinks of it as McDonald's, and McDonald's is responsible for the nugget that everyone eats today. But a couple of years before the McDonald's nugget, there was a professor at Cornell who was tasked with finding other things to do with chicken, the equivalent of chicken salami and chicken ham and so forth, Robert Baker. And he, in fact, came up with chicken hot dogs and chicken cold cuts, but his enduring invention was what he called the chicken stick, which 17 years later would be renamed the chicken nugget. And that changed chicken consumption forever. And now we eat twice as much chicken as we do beef, whereas 60 years ago it would have been the reverse.
Huh. Now, what is acronized chicken? Where... just the look on your face is not appetizing.
So to tell this story of how on earth agriculture got so entwined with antibiotics, I kept stepping back and back and back through the history. And in one of the papers that I ran across, there was a title, Antibiotics and Food Preservation. And I thought, wait a minute, that sounds a little odd.
Yeah.
I thought we were talking about food production. What does food preservation have to do with antibiotics? Well, the answer is, for about 10 years in the late 50s and early 60s, chicken and fish were dipped in antibiotics before they were packaged, while they were raw. The idea being that they would be left with a film of antibiotics on the raw meat so that the packages could last on the shelf or in a cold case, not for a couple of days, but for a couple of weeks. The way you were looking at me is exactly the look I had on my face when I read this evidence for the first time. It was absurd. But this went on. And the industry was essentially the pharma industry who came up with this. This was the creation of one of the companies that made one of the antibiotics. They were very proud of this. And even as far back as the 1960s, they had a very smart media strategy. They wined and dined food editors. They bought ads in the glossy magazines. They came up with a seal that's kind of like the good housekeeping seal so that individual grocery stores and newspapers could say, our chicken is acronized. And what it really meant was our chicken is coming into your kitchen carrying a film of raw antibiotic. Good luck, homemaker.
And so you've got chicken and fish dipped in antibiotics. And this is like people are getting sick from this.
It's true. So the way that when I look back at this long history, there were so many things that people tried without any sense of what the downsides might be. I mean, they had no consciousness or a refusal to consider that there might be unintended consequences. And one of the unintended consequences of acronizing is that slaughterhouse workers start to get really sick. And the person who discovers this is an epidemiologist in Seattle, which at the time was not that big a city. And a lot of the doctors were in touch with the health department. And this doctor in the health department realizes he's getting phone calls from a lot of doctors out in the community who all have men coming to them with weird sores running up their arms. And it turns out they all work in a slaughterhouse that is using this acronizing process. So they are dunking their arms and hands into the tubs that the chicken is being dipped in, and they're picking up bacteria from them. Now, the antibiotic dip was supposed to kill bacteria, but it turns out that these chickens on the farms where they were grown were already getting antibiotics. They were carrying superbugs with them into the slaughterhouse, into the antibiotic dip. The superbugs were not being killed, and they were making the men sick instead. And that outbreak is what starts the journey away from acronizing as a thing that was a positive scientific good.
Holy smokes. Okay, so how is it possible that this happened? I mean, was the FDA involved?
Oh, the FDA gave a license to this. When I look back at the early actions of the feds around this, it really is just amazing that everyone has this uncomplicated positive trust in science, that everything it does is, you know, this is the better living through chemistry years, uh-huh. Right? And it's not really until the 1970s, after enough outbreaks of antibiotic-resistant illness related to food have happened in England, in Europe, and then in the United States, that the FDA actually starts to try to move against it, but is not successful. For decades is held at bay by political interests.
Mm-hmm. So a caller asks a question that I've been meaning to ask because it's fascinating to me. And this caller wants to know, why does giving antibiotics to chickens cause them to gain weight? I always thought that these were two separate things, antibiotics and then the fact that chickens were like exploding in terms of their size were two completely separate things, but instead they're one and the same.
That's right. So antibiotics, the use of antibiotics in chickens and cattle and pigs starts this move toward the bigger and bigger animals that we have today. Now, after that, after a while, precision genetics gets into the act and precision nutrition as well.
Yeah, see, that's what I thought was making them bigger. But
So what happens is, they didn't know this in the 1950s, but what we would say now is that the antibiotics cause a perturbation of the gut microbiome. So basically, we all have bacteria in our guts all the time, right? Every living thing does. And when the animals are given antibiotics in their food and water, it shifts the balance of the families of antibiotics that are in their gut in such a way that those bacteria become resistant, but also they take nutrition up into the rest of the animal's body in a different way. So the finding back in 1948 that started all this was that chicks given antibiotics in their feed, tiny, tiny doses, way smaller than would cure an infection, gained weight at three times the rate of chicks that hadn't gotten any antibiotics at all. Now, that was in a lab. It never worked quite that well in the real world, but for a really significant period of time, farmers who gave antibiotics to their animals could count on a 10% greater weight gain, or they could get their animals to the market weight they needed faster, essentially 10% faster, which meant more animals in a year or less spending on feed in a year. Hmm. So it was just pure economic benefit.
I was going to say, again, it all goes back to the bottom line. Now, you can't talk about chickens without talking about Purdue Farms. So how did Purdue Farms begin to change its mind about the use of antibiotics?
Yeah, this is a really interesting story. You know, I think, as somebody who writes about food and science, of that the heroes of the story are always going to be the small farmers with the beautiful green farms and the happy chickens and pigs roaming mm-hmm. around, right? So those people are heroes as well. But it turns out that what we think of as like big food has a role to play in this story. So in 2014, Jim Purdue, who's the third generation to head Purdue Farms, you know, his dad was Frank Purdue, the "it takes a tough man to make a tender chicken." Jim Purdue calls a press conference out of nowhere in 2014 in Washington, D.C., and not that far from their headquarters, and stands up and announces that his company is not using antibiotics in its chicken anymore, and in fact hasn't been for a number of years. And completely astounds the rest of his industry, which to this point has been moving in lockstep along with the cattle and pig industries in asserting that antibiotic use is an uncomplicated good thing. So that was a couple of years ago. At this point, Purdue is pretty close to 100% antibiotic-free. They changed the diets of their chickens, so they give them herbs and essential oils and fatty acids. Yeah, really, like thyme and oregano and cinnamon and yucca if you smell the feed, it smells like a pizza. It's amazing. The chickens don't taste like pizza, I want to be clear. They have done things that allow the chickens to get their own immune systems back, like letting them have exercise and putting windows into the barn so they get natural light.
And this is all part of their animal welfare plan,
it's true.
Right?
Yeah. And so this is, you know, big companies are what move markets. When they change their minds on something, that's really when an industry turns around.
Mm-hmm.
So as amazing as it's been to always have those beautiful small farmers with the gorgeous green pastures, you know, sort of carrying forward an image of farming, it's because of companies like Purdue and all the companies that rolled in line after them, Tyson and Cargill and Costco and Pilgrim's Pride and so forth, and even Foster Farms that we talked about before, that have really changed the poultry history around.
But so then Purdue does this press conference, as you says, shocks everyone. But of course, I'm now thinking, well, wait a minute. What was that moment that led Purdue Farms to decide to get away from antibiotics? Was it a bottom line decision? Or was it, you know, we shouldn't be treating chickens this way?
So I think a couple of things happened for them at once. The thing that didn't happen, at least not that they've admitted to publicly, is that no one stood up in their company and said, I think we are contributing to antibiotic resistance and we should stop.
Right.
But what did happen is that while, you know, the feds never really moved on antibiotics until just a few years ago, but a consumer movement grew up that made, you know, schools and hospitals and parents and chefs all started to say to chicken producers, we really want to see antibiotic-free meat instead. And Purdue keeps in very close touch with its customers. At the same time, it has enough internal science carried out by its veterinarians that it looked at whether it really needed those drugs anymore. And the answer turned out to be no. So they could save the money they were spending and satisfy their customers at the same time.
And real quickly, there's another question that came up in terms of antibiotics. Are doctors somewhat complicit in how they have prescribed antibiotics too liberally for things where they haven't been useful?
So,
real quickly,
antibiotic resistance is the fault of agriculture and of medicine. It's not either or, it's both and.
Both and. I've been speaking with award-winning journalist and author Maren McKenna. Her latest book is Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. I got to tell you, tomorrow night at 7:30, she'll be speaking with Helen Rosner at Caveat NYC. For more information, visit our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. Thank you so much.
Thank you.